And as is our tradition, I would like to offer a prayerful invitation to bring us into presence with the words taken from the Persian poet and Sufi mystic Rumi as we continue our journey into the wisdom way of knowing. Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, it doesn't matter. Ours is not a caravan of despair. Come, even if you have broken your vows 1,000 times. Come yet again. Come, come. And may we bring our whole selves into conscious awareness as we receive the words of wisdom from our esteemed speaker, Reverend Matthew Wright. It's my great pleasure and honor to introduce Matthew, a beloved voice in our wider wisdom community. Not only is he a gifted wisdom teacher in the tradition of Cynthia Bourgeau, he's an Episcopal priest, a writer, a retreat leader. He's the priest of St. Gregory's Episcopal Church in Woodstock, New York, and also a primary teacher for the Wisdom Waypoints and Contemplative Society, expanding the teachings of the Christian mystical and contemplative wisdom tradition. Matthew is a wonderful choice to lead us today in an exploration of the reawakening of our deep roots of the wisdom pathway within Christianity, and also the inner spiritual headwaters of all the great traditions, the religious traditions. His spiritual formation has developed along both the Christian and Sufi path within the traditions of the Episcopal Church, wisdom schools, and the Sufi teachings of Kabir and Kamil Helminski. And in addition to being an Episcopal priest, Matthew also describes himself as a dervish in the Sufi tradition. And now we are pleased to continue our tradition of welcoming and blessing our speaker with our late Tom Heck's beautiful blessing song. So please raise your hands in blessing as we hear these words and join in with us.
We bless you as you share your gifts of spirit, light, and insight. We welcome you with joy.
And I give you our dear friend, Matthew.
Thank you, Mary Ann and Judith and Tim, for organizing and gathering us together, and all of you for joining in this morning. It's wonderful to follow on Heather's excellent presentation last week, where she gave us such a coherent, beautiful summation of the wisdom tradition. And we're continuing this morning with the first chapter of The Wisdom Way of Knowing. And rather than just do a sort of general overview of the chapter, I thought I would zero in on one aspect of this chapter. And Cynthia reminds us that wisdom is, of course, a universal phenomenon, that wisdom represents a unitive cosmology. It represents a path of transformation. And so that's where we're going to head for the next half hour or so. We'll look at Jesus as a master of wisdom. And depending on how much time we have, we might turn the corner a bit and also look at what it means to call Jesus a master of the heart, a master of wisdom and a master of the heart. The heart understood as that organ of spiritual perception within the wisdom teaching, that it isn't just the center of our mushy-gushy emotional life, our feelings, but that the heart, when it's purified, when it's opened, it's an eye from which we see from oneness, from wholeness. So that's where I want to head. And all of this will unfold against what we might call unitive or a non-dual backdrop. And non-dual is really a loan word from Eastern traditions. There's the Sanskrit word Advaita, which means not two, or we translate it as non-dual. But the classical Christian word is simply the unitive way. And we've said that the wisdom journey unfolds in the classical tradition, across these three primary stages. So we say that as the spiritual journey begins, there is the purgative journey, the way of purgation. And this is when we first kind of wake up and go, oh my God, my ego has its grubby, sticky little fingers all over everything that I do. My ego has been running the show and I was unaware of it. And so there's a journey of purgation, of learning to loosen the hold of our ego over our lives, which leads into what's classically called the illuminative journey, the journey of illumination, where more and more the light of Christ, the light of God, is dawning in our hearts and in our lives. And that leads us finally into what's referred to as the unitive journey, or the way of union, where we're living more and more consciously from our oneness with God and from our oneness with all that is. And so this is sometimes in old medieval roadmaps been unfolded as a ladder that we climb. But I think it's but much better for us to understand it as a spiral that we spiral through again and again over the course of a lifetime. Maybe even during the course of one period of prayer. We go through a journey of purgation and illumination and union, which opens a whole new level of purgation that we need to pass through, and deepening illumination and deepening union. But the tradition says that union is always the deepest, most fundamental truth. That oneness with God is the most fundamental truth of all that is. And so we see that unitive teaching on the mouth of Jesus when he says, "I and the Father are one." And we've sometimes wanted to install a glass ceiling and say, "Oh, only Jesus gets to say that, no one else." But if we say that, then we negate his own prayer at the end of John's gospel. May they all be one as you and I are one. May the whole human family enter into that experience of divine human unity. And so we see this unfolding in the teachings of St. Paul, who says, "It is no longer I who lives, but Christ who lives in me." He's living from that unitive realization. All the way through the Christian mystical tradition, St. John of the Cross, who says, "The center of the soul is God," or Catherine of Genoa, who cried out, "My deepest me is God." And so I want to keep that unitive understanding as the backdrop against which we're working as we move through this, and to see Jesus really as a master of that unitive wisdom, that unitive realization. And to speak of Jesus as a wisdom teacher, we have to define what we mean by wisdom. And Heather began that work for us last week. So I won't dig too much more into that, but I want to just offer one succinct definition of wisdom that comes from Cynthia Bourgeau. And I'll read this a couple times so it can really sink in. Cynthia writes, "Wisdom describes a lineage of spiritual knowledge and practice that is principally concerned with the alchemy of transformation. It is not about knowing more, but about knowing more deeply. And it can be recognized by an alert, present moment awareness and a compassionate intelligence." So to read that again and break it down a bit, wisdom describes a lineage of knowledge and practice. And so this is crucial. It's not just knowledge. It also is practice. The rubber has to meet the road. We have to put this path into practice in our life. And it is concerned with the alchemy of transformation, of spiritual awakening. It's not about giving us a new belief system. It's about waking us up from the inside out. And she says it's not about knowing more, as in knowing more facts and figures, more theological concepts, the kind of stuff you get in seminary where you try to dump as much church history and systematic theology into your head as possible. So it's not about knowing more in that way. It's about knowing more deeply, knowing with our whole self, as Heather explained last week, knowing with all three centers of our being online. And it's characterized by an alert, present moment awareness. Here I am in this moment. not running off into the past or into an imagined future, but being fully grounded and anchored in the now. And she says that it's characterized by a compassionate or a loving intelligence. And I love that she brings these words together here, that compassion or love is seen as an intelligence. We often think of love as just a feeling, but here we can talk about the intelligence of love. And I would say that when we know our oneness with God and each other, with each other and all creation, when we know that oneness in a deep, felt, lived sense, that knowing is love. Love is what flows when everything else falls away, when everything that obscures our vision of that deep unity, when that falls away, judgment and blame fall away, and love is what remains. And Cynthia says that it's the spiritual practices of attention and surrender that become the riverbanks between which wisdom flows. That we need riverbanks, that a river without riverbanks is just a swamp. And so attention and surrender are the two riverbanks. Attention is that open awareness, that conscious presence, moment by moment. And surrender is that letting go of our egoic ambitions, motivations, control. And when we can stand fully present and fully surrendered, then wisdom flows through the channel of our open hearts. And so this is the wisdom path that we're talking about. And this is what the Christian wisdom tradition tells us that Jesus taught. But not only is it what he taught, it's where he taught from. He taught from this center, from this deeper knowing. And it's why he was able to offer forgiveness from a cross. He was so fully present and so fully surrendered, he could forgive in that deepest moment of anguish, when we would understand if he had cursed and blamed and, you know, spat at his enemies. But because he's so attentive and so surrendered, he can offer love even from that moment. And strangely enough, somehow over the course of the centuries, we've lost sight of this path of wisdom, and we've turned Christianity again and again into a belief system or into a belonging club. It's about believing the right things in order to get into heaven when you die, rather than living in the right way to manifest heaven while we're alive. And so I want to look back at the ministry of Jesus in the Gospels to get an eye to this wisdom teaching. And in our classic Christian creeds, we often jump from he was born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, died, and was buried. We go right from birth to suffering and death. But what's happening in the 33 years in between those two bookends? And we see a beautiful teaching ministry unfolding. And so if we look at the shape of that ministry, we see that it doesn't really fit the classic models that most of us have inherited for thinking of Jesus. And depending on the tradition you grew up in, if you were raised in the Christian tradition, we often have spoken of Jesus's threefold office as prophet, priest, and king. And I would suggest that he doesn't really fit neatly in any of those molds. King is what he rejects when the tempter and his temptations in the wilderness takes him up on a high mountain, says you can have all the kingdoms of the world, and he rejects it. He rejects worldly power. And so he's a king in the sense of the anti-king. He's the subversive one who stands power on its head. Priest. Well, again, he's only the most subversive of priests. He wasn't a priest of the institutional temple complex. He wasn't one of the ones who offered sacrifices of animals to mediate between God and humanity. We call him a priest after the order of Melchizedek, which is this mysterious, subversive, non-institutional priesthood. And so again, that stood on its head. And prophet, he most closely fits the model of the Hebrew prophets, perhaps, who rail against social injustice and religious hypocrisy. But they tend to speak, Isaiah or Hosea or Malachi, they speak in divine proclamation, thus says the Lord, and they channel the divine voice. But we see Jesus actually speaks in another way, in what the Jewish tradition calls mashal. And if you've read this chapter, you've encountered this word mashal. Is the Hebrew word for parable or wisdom teaching. And there was a great current of Jewish wisdom teaching that Jesus lived and moved in. And in wisdom teaching, you use stories that are meant to short circuit your usual mode of perception. They are most closely akin to what in the Zen tradition are called koans. And a koan is a teaching story that you can't actually solve with your rational mind. It's a story that sort of short circuits your usual ways of thinking. And this is what we see Jesus doing again and again. He offers these teaching stories and wisdom sayings that are meant to break us into a new way of seeing and perceiving. So for example, you might remember the parable of the workers in the field who each go out at different times of day to work. And at the end, they're all paid the same amount of money. And our rational mind says, but that's not fair. Our calculating, quantifying, judging mind cries out, that's not fair. But Jesus is trying to short circuit that mode of perception and break our mind open into our heart. So if we look at his teachings as a whole, they stay pretty close to this ground of inner transformation. They ask questions like, how do I lose my life in order to find life? He teaches about this vision he calls the kingdom of God, which is really juxtaposed with the kingdom of Rome, the empires of this world, which are based on hierarchy and separation. And he imagines a kingdom of God that's based on unity and equality. And he says that kingdom is already within us and around us. And he invites us to wake up into it. So again, this is about changing our mode of perception. He teaches about surrender, about forgiving, about letting go. How many times must I forgive? He's asked 7 times, and he responds, no, 70 times, 7 times. Let go, let go, let go. Pattern surrender and forgiveness so deeply into your being that it's the natural gesture of your inner life. And he teaches these wonderfully non-dual teachings that are also so simple, something as simple as love your neighbor as yourself. We tend to insert into that, love your neighbor as much as you love yourself. But no, he says, love your neighbor as yourself. What is it for me to see my neighbor as an extension of my own self? That there's only one life here. The great Indian sage Ramana Maharshi, when he was asked, how should we treat others? He simply responded, there are no others. And that's what Jesus is pointing to here. So these are all deeply transformational teachings that aren't about really belief, theology, doctrine, as much as they are about a way of seeing. And if you remember those times in the Gospels when Jesus calls out something like, or teaches about something like murder or adultery, as he does in the Sermon on the Mount, he sort of shockingly pushes past these outer actions of murder and adultery. And he says, oh, I'm more interested in anger and lust. And we've tended to hear that with a Western moralistic ear as Jesus upping the ante. He's saying, oh, forget about murder and adultery. You're not even allowed to get angry or lust. But when we look at him as a wisdom teacher, we see what he's actually doing. He's telling us we have to confront our outer actions at the point of their arising, well before an action like murder has manifested itself. There was this initial stirring of anger within our being. He says we have to go down to the roots of our anger and transform it from the inside out. And so that's why he always points us back inside. He essentially says, you know, this wisdom path is an inside job. It's a totally inside job. And this is why he gives us that wonderful teaching on those he perceives as hypocrites. He calls out those he perceives as religious hypocrites as whitewashed tombs. Or in the old King James Version, he says whited sepulchres. This idea that we're a stately mausoleum on the outside, but on the inside, we're filled with a corpse, with rot. And so he says, we can have all the right outer actions, but we can be performing them from a place of self-righteousness. And so he says, unless the inner is in alignment with the outer, then we haven't actually stepped onto the path of wisdom. You can change your outer actions all you want. It's not yet the wisdom path until you start transforming yourself from the inside out. And significantly in the Gospels, as a wisdom teacher, Jesus is always responding situationally. Wisdom is always situational. There's never a one-size-fits-all or a blanket teaching on the wisdom path. And a good example of this is, you may remember a story in which a rich young man comes to see Jesus, and he asks for what he can do to further his own spiritual development. And he says, I've kept all the commandments. What more can I do? And Jesus says, okay, if you really want to continue on the path, then sell all you have, give the money to the poor, and then come and follow me. And we're told that the young man went away deeply grieved, for he had many possessions. He owned a lot of stuff. Well, is this a universal teaching that everyone who's going to follow Jesus has to sell all they have? Or is this a specific teaching? Again, if everyone sells everything that they have, well, who are they going to sell it to? Because there's no one left. So if we hang with this thread just a little bit later, a few paragraphs later, we see Jesus meets a man remembered as the Gerasene demoniac. He's this man who's broken in heart and mind and soul, and he's living out in a cemetery in chains, really representing, you know, he's a model of a life of inner fragmentation. And Jesus restores him to wholeness. And then this man says, I am ready to leave everything to follow you on the road. And Jesus says, no, you go back and live among your people. You go back into your community. So it's the exact opposite advice as what he's just given to the rich young man. And what I would propose is that Jesus, as a wisdom teacher, he's looking for our stuck point. Where is your ego fixation? And then he's going to leverage right at that point to open you into freedom. And so for the rich young man, he sees that his ego fixation, his identification is around his possessions. His identity is bound up in what he owns. And if he's to know inner freedom, he has to be freed from that attachment. Now we come to the Gerasene demoniac, and perhaps for his maturation on the path, he needs to learn what it's like to be responsible and to live in community. And so Jesus says, no, you go back and have a livelihood and live among your people, because that's what will most help him develop on the path. And so this is how wisdom teaching always works. It's geared to the moment and to the person. And the final point about this teaching is to come back to that word unitive or non-dual. It's always a non-dual teaching. Jesus is always working to break his students out of dualistic either or us versus them modes of perception. And we can see this in the way he uses outsiders like Samaritans and Romans, which to translate that into our context, heretics and pagans. The Roman is a pagan outside of the Jewish tradition, and the Samaritan is considered a heretic who is modeling a version of the Hebrew scriptures and tradition that's considered unorthodox. And so Jesus takes a pagan and a heretic and uses them as an example of where to look for a model of good faith. So he says of a Roman centurion, I found greater faith in you than in in all of Israel than in my own religious tradition. And we're not told, and then the Roman converted to Orthodox Judaism on the spot. No, he goes off, he's still a Roman, but Jesus says, look at the faith in this person. And the same with the parable of the Good Samaritan. The Samaritan, the heretic, Jesus says, is actually the one who models true neighborliness. And then we're not told, and then the Samaritan gave up his Samaritan ways and converted to Orthodox Judaism. No, he goes off still a Samaritan. And so it's Jesus' way of saying, look beyond your Orthodox boxes and boundaries for where the holy can be found. He models this also by drawing women into his close inner circle of students. And he's breaking down gender binaries in doing this. And we often lose sight of this, but one of the best examples of this is when Mary and Martha, Jesus is in their home, and Mary sits at Jesus' feet to receive the teaching. And Martha, who we're told is busy and distracted by many things, she comes in and says, hey, send Mary back into the kitchen. And we've tended to read this as an active contemplative divide, that Mary is the contemplative and Martha is the active one, and it's about prioritizing contemplation. I think we can also read it through first century gender lenses, though. Mary is claiming a man's seat. Women did not sit in the inner circle at the feet of a rabbi. Women served the men, and if they were going to listen to the teaching, they stood in the back of the room where they weren't a distraction. Mary brazenly comes and sits in the inner circle at the feet of a rabbi. And Martha comes in entirely embarrassed, apologizing for her sister, and says, send her back to a woman's place. And Jesus says, no, she's chosen the better part, and it will not be taken from her because she's a woman. So we can see in these actions, Jesus breaking down these gendered roles as well that create so much of the us and them in our world. And another great moment is when some disciples come to him. They've been out healing and preaching, and they say, Jesus, we encountered someone down the road who's healing, who's doing good deeds in your name, and he's not in our club. He's not one of your students. Do you want us to curse him, to smite him, to... And I always imagine Jesus sort of stops and rolls his eyes and he says, no, whoever is not against us is for us, even if they're not on our team and our club. We could translate this into our interspiritual world. Jesus, there were some Muslims and Buddhists doing good work out there. Should we prevent them? And Jesus says, no, whoever's not against us is for us. We're all in this together. Cut out this othering, this us versus them game. And he holds this, as I said before, he holds this seeing from oneness all the way down to his dying breath. That one moment where we could most forgive him for falling into the dualistic mind and cursing his murderers. Instead, he says, forgive them. They do not know what they are doing. And he dies in love. He dies forgiving. He dies holding the oneness down to that final breath. And this, of course, is in fulfillment of that prayer, may they all be one. He will not make an other, an enemy, even out of his own murderer. So this is what Jesus is up to in his ministry. He is modeling a teaching and a path of transformation. And he's trying to liberate us from our egoic attachments and compulsions. And this is what the contemplative path has always been about. This is the work of the contemplative way, of the wisdom way. It's about cultivating enough inner spaciousness in our being that we don't fall into old patterns of reactivity and dualistic opposition. It's about rewiring old patterns and habits and conditioning so that there's more room for love and patience and understanding in our being. And this is where a regular disciplined contemplative practice of some form is really essential for students on a wisdom path. This is where the rubber has to meet the road. We have to pattern this into our being through practice. And we know that Jesus himself, in fact, had a contemplative practice and rhythm in his life. How do we know that? because the gospel texts tell us that. And Mark's gospel, in fact, records Jesus' practice for us like this. Mark tells us, early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up and went out to a quiet place, and there he prayed. So this is a practice, a discipline that Jesus engages in regularly, if not daily. Early in the morning, while it's still dark, before he's been pulled into the hustle and bustle of the day, he gets up, goes to a quiet place, and grounds and centers himself in prayer and God. And from out of that deep grounding, he then moves into the needs of the world and the demands of the day. And we see him modeling this contemplative rhythm throughout his ministry. As he goes out and engages the crowds, when he's reaching that point of burnout, he'll say to the disciples, come, let us go away to a quiet place. He'll say, let's get in the boat and go to the other side of the lake, or let's go for a hike up the mountain together. And so there's a constant rhythm of engagement and then withdrawal and recharging. But we could say that Jesus' model of contemplation, he never withdraws into contemplation for the sake of escape from the world. It's always this for the sake of preparing himself for a deeper, fuller, and freer engagement with the world. You're not running away. You're actually readying yourself to more fully engage. And so we could say he models the way of the contemplative activist or the social justice mystic. He's always holding those two together in his life. And while we don't know what his method of prayer was, what was he doing in his periods of silence? Was he saying his centering prayer word? Was he praying the Jesus prayer? Was he praying the rosary, Hail Mary, Hail Mom, full of grace? We don't know what his method was. Those particular methods come later. But we do know very early on what Christian contemplatives were doing, because we have the writings of the desert Abbas and Ammas, the desert mothers and fathers. And we see that they practiced a heart-centered form of contemplative prayer. And I think it's pretty safe to say we see in those writings on heart-centered contemplation, a thread that goes right from the desert tradition back through the apostles, right back to the heart of Jesus himself. So that's what I want to end with, is us looking at Jesus as a master of the heart. A friend of mine, she calls herself a Buddhist Christian. She says she's a Buddhist Christian because Jesus tells her to love her neighbor, and the Buddha tells her how to love her neighbor. That Buddhism gave her practices that helped her embody the love Jesus called her to. And so it's that how piece that's dropped out of the roadmap for many of us in the Christian West. But it's not because it was never there. In fact, it was the very heart of what Jesus was up to and the very heart of the early desert tradition. So that's where I want to end. I want us to turn to what that early practice was. And let me look at the time here. So I think we've got enough minutes to do just a little practice. And a word about the way the Christian tradition understands the human person. What we could say our anthropology is, what's the nature of the human being. And it says that the human being is essentially an amphibious being. We are designed to live in two worlds at once. The way a frog can both live on land and in the water, the human being is designed to be able to live in both time and eternity. And our tradition has used the cross as a symbol of this. And so we talk about the horizontal arm of the cross and the vertical arm of the cross. The horizontal beam of the cross represents our life and time. Here we are, plodding along with a linear story, with our own personal drama that's unfolding from past into future. And most of us, most of the time, are so fused to the horizontal axis of our being that it's all we know exists. We just are this story unfolding in time. But the wisdom tradition says there's also this vertical axis, which is the eternal, the infinite. Spirit, and it's always intersecting with and breaking through into our life and time. And we can cultivate awareness of that other dimension by walking the wisdom path. And if you map the two arms of the cross over the human body, where do they intersect? Of course, in the heart center. The heart is the meeting point in this tradition of time and eternity. It's where, it's the bridal chamber where the marriage of heaven and earth takes place. And so this tradition said, how do we draw the mind into the heart? And they understood the mind as our dualistic faculty of perception. We've got this dualistic apparatus that sees by way of splitting the world up into parts and pieces, into subject, object, us and them. It measures what we sometimes call the quantitative universe, universe of quantities that we can measure. And that's fantastic. We need a faculty that can engage the quantitative universe. But there is also a qualitative universe, a universe of qualities, beauty, truth, love, joy. We can't measure these, but we can perceive them with the heart. And they saw that the heart, as an organ of perception, it actually knows from wholeness, from resonance, and the heart reads things from the inside out. It moves into sympathetic resonance with another person, another being, with a tree, with a leaf. It moves into sympathetic resonance and reads the reality of that other from the inside out. We don't need to cut something open to understand it. And so they worked to bring awareness into the heart center. And that's where I want to end, is just taking a moment to come into the heart center. And so let's just bring attention to our breath for a moment. Jesus says, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. The understanding in the wisdom tradition is not blessed are the pure in heart now, for they shall see God later when they die, but rather that when we purify and open the eye of our heart, we see God in every face, in every facet of creation. We see the one in whom we live and move and have our being. And so taking a moment to bring awareness to your breath as it rises and falls in your chest. And to sense that rhythm of your heart as it beats. The breath and the heart like our built-in prayer beads, always calling us back to the life of God, coursing through us moment by moment. And I invite you to imagine a non-dimensional point within this heart space. You can imagine it there in the center of your chest. And it's a point that opens out into infinite spaciousness. It's a point that is a channel from your heart into the divine heart. And if you have a sacred word, a centering prayer word, or a mantra that you work with, you might add it into the silence, but sounding it not in your mental center, but sounding it in the cave of your heart. And if you don't have a word, you might take a simple word like love and just place that word in the cave of your heart and sound it there on your in-breath and your out-breath as an anchor. Or you can simply use the breath alone as your anchor. If you find awareness pulling into your mental center, just redirect it with your breath, with a word gently placed over your heart center, or with a sacred word sounded in the cave of your heart. Just rest in the tender spaciousness of your heart as you're able. You might imagine Jesus early in the morning, while it was still dark, getting up, going to a quiet place, and grounding himself in this way in his own heart. Perhaps offering that intimate name he used for the divine, Abba. Or we might say Amma, sounding it in his heart as he grounded himself in the One. And that as you ground in your heart, you touch into the heart of Christ itself. You touch into the one heart of God, which expresses itself uniquely in and through and as each of our hearts. You can imagine the field of your heart opening out in such a way that it's not just that your heart is in your body, but that your body is held in the field of your heart, and that this heartful presence permeates every cell of your being. Heartfulness in your toes and your fingers and your whole being, your whole self, a heart. An expression of God's heart here in this world of time. And then as you're ready, you can allow your eyes to open. Staying grounded in that spaciousness. And as we prepare ourselves to move into some sharing time together, you can take as a question into our small groups, into our breakout groups, this question of Jesus' own question, who do you say that I am, spoken to his students. And as you approach Jesus in this wisdom context, which doesn't remove any of the other dimensions of who he is, but that brings to the fore one dimension of who he is, a teacher of wisdom and a master of the heart, these dimensions we've often lost sight of. As you see that path of wisdom coming to the fore and how you might approach Yeshua, approach Jesus, who does he become for you? What is the invitation in seeing him that way? And seeing him also as a sacrament, a disclosure of the mystery at the heart of all of us. He is that union of the human and the divine, of the vertical axis and the horizontal axis of the created and the uncreated. And he invites us to find that union of the infinite and the finite in the bridal chamber of our own hearts, that we bear that mystery that is revealed in him at the heart of our own being. And so talk about Jesus in the context of wisdom, perhaps how this opens him up in a new way, or how this challenges your perception of him, whatever's alive, you can bring that into conversation in the small groups. Back over to our leadership.